Welcome back. This is Series 2, Episode 1 of Nightmares of a Doctor. This series explores the extremes of human existence. Some of the themes in these stories will be challenging, and listener discretion is advised. If you are suffering from a mental health condition and find yourself in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything. Grantham is a quiet town in the East Midlands of England. 60 miles to the west is the urban metropolis of Birmingham, and an hour's drive east will take you to England's historic eastern coastline, whose wide sandy beaches and rugged coastal paths overlook the North Sea. Surrounding Grantham is a wealth of quintessential English countryside, vast green fields, ancient woodlands, and the rolling hills of the Lincolnshire Wolds. In 1991, it could have been mistaken as an idyllic place to live, or indeed to raise a family. But already by then, something very strange was beginning to happen there. Grantham Hospital lies just north of the town. A cornerstone of the community, the hospital had been opened in 1876, and it had since evolved into a modern hospital offering maternity, pediatric, and emergency services. In the spring of 1991, hospital staff were contending with a spate of unexpected collapses, each one occurring on Ward 4, the paediatric unit. Liam Taylor was 8 weeks old when he was admitted to the ward with a chest infection on the 19th of February 1991. His illness was moderate, his admission to hospital considered overall necessary but largely precautionary. On the second day of his stay, the assessing doctors and respiratory physiotherapist were reassured by his condition and pleased with his progress. The nurse in charge at the time had been organising routine monitoring of Liam and the rest of the patients on the ward. No immediate concerns were raised, and she and the other staff were planning their meal breaks. Liam's parents were with him at the time. They sat at his bedside, admiring their young child, while chatting pleasantly to the nursing staff. After a while, the two left to find food, before returning to the ward just 90 minutes later. But before they had managed to get back to Liam's bedside, they were intercepted by a concerned-looking nurse. The nurse informed them that their son had become rapidly unwell in the time they'd been away. He had been violently sick, and his breathing had deteriorated sufficiently for him to require additional oxygen support. They rushed to their boy to find him lying lifeless in his bed, an oxygen mask now clamped across his face. Both stayed by his side constantly through the night, and by the following morning, his condition had improved. He was opening his eyes and reaching for his teddy bear. His parents felt sure that the worst was now behind them. The following night, the sleep-deprived parents sought rest in the parents' room provided by the ward. Despite their anxiety, they managed to find sleep. But then they were woken at 5 o'clock in the morning by the panic-stricken ward staff. Liam's heart had stopped beating. Every hospital has a designated crash team that is continuously staffed every hour of the day, every day of the year. Each member of the crash team receives rigorous resuscitation training so that they are competent in dealing with a range of severe illnesses that cause the lungs to stop breathing or the heart to stop beating. If anyone in the hospital is treating a patient who happens to deteriorate to a sufficient degree, the bleeping systems will be activated and the crash team are summoned. The crash team came for Liam. They arrived to a child who was deathly pale, with dark red splotches scattered across his face. One of the doctors held Liam's 8-week-old chest between his two hands, with two thumbs centered upon the sternum of Liam's chest. In coordinated pulses, the two thumbs rhythmically squeezed on Liam's sternum and the heart underneath it, thereby replicating the pumping of his inert heart. Through the use of drugs and continued chest compressions, the crash team were able to restart Liam's heart, but already a significant damage had been done. His oxygen-starved blood caused a severe damage to his brain. He now remained completely unresponsive, not even able to support his own breathing. Complex life support was required to keep Liam alive, and in the days that followed, he showed no signs of improvement. Liam's parents were faced with an agonizing decision. They took all of the appropriate medical advice before resolving to remove their baby from life support. Liam died shortly after. His death was deemed as an unfortunate complication of his respiratory infection. Just 2 weeks after baby Liam died, a 1-year-old called Kaylee Desmond was admitted onto the very same bed. She was admitted onto Ward 4 with a chest infection. Her illness was moderate, but she responded well to antibiotic treatment. After 5 days of treatment, there was every expectation that as her condition improved, she could soon be discharged home. When nursing staff noticed that her breathing was quickening, they moved quickly to review her remaining vital signs. Her heart rate was up and her blood pressure was down, both concerning signs that her heart was beginning to fail. Doctors were called urgently, but Kaylee's breathing was rapidly deteriorating, and then Kaylee's heart stopped altogether. The crash team was summoned and a resuscitation was commenced. The quick-thinking medical team were able to revive her and restart her faltering heart. Once her condition had been stabilized, Kaylee was transferred for more specialist care at a hospital in nearby Nottingham. Kaylee was improving, but on a routine examination, an observant doctor noticed something strange. She observed a puncture wound in the fold of Kaylee's skin, high up in her armpit. Just adjacent to the puncture wound, an air bubble was discovered in the muscle underlying the skin. The doctors were alarmed by this unexpected and bizarre examination finding, but Kaylee's condition had improved and they attributed the wound to an accidental injection. Her care was continued and the incidental finding was dismissed as irrelevant. Although the puncture wound in Kaylee's armpit had been dismissed by the ward team, an injection of air can be potentially catastrophic, not least for a 1-year-old with a pre-existing chest infection. If air is injected through a needle and into a vein, it will form an elongated bubble within that vein, which is otherwise full of flowing deoxygenated blood. That vein transports blood back to the heart, and the injected bubble will travel along with it. After entering the heart, the blood's next stop is to be pumped towards the lungs. But if the size of the bubble is sufficiently large enough, it will effectively block off the blood supply to the lungs, preventing unoxygenated blood from being nourished by the oxygen-rich air that is simultaneously inhaled through the lungs' airways. With blood blocked by the bubble, the affected patient will immediately become breathless. In certain cases, it may even be enough to kill. That is why doctors and nurses will carefully check for bubbles in their syringes. You will see them bring syringes up close to eye level, tapping them gently to dislodge small bubbles, before gently squeezing on the syringe's plunger, ejecting any bubbles that may have inadvertently formed. As the plunger is pushed, a small amount of collateral fluid will often go with it, a visual reassurance that the gas bubbles have been removed and that the syringe now contains its intended content. Fortunately for Kaylee, she completed her recovery at the Queen's Medical Center in Nottingham, after which she was discharged, healthy and well, to a grateful and loving family. Back at Grantham Hospital, Ward 4 was admitting its latest patient. Timothy Hardwick was an 11-year-old boy who suffered from cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy is a neurological condition related to problems in the development of the fetal brain while in the mother's womb, or it may be due to complications during childbirth. It affects the child's brain to varying degrees, from being virtually unnoticeable to causing severe disability, which may even result in the death of the child. For Timothy, his symptoms manifested with altered development and mild neurological symptoms, which were occasionally prone to flaring up. On the 5th of March 1991, he was admitted to Ward 4 with an epileptic seizure, which his parents were unable to safely manage at home. The immediate management of a seizure involves protecting the individual from any self-inflicted injuries, such as tongue biting or muscle spasm. In some cases, anti-epileptic medication may be used to help terminate the seizure. Once the patient has stopped seizing, close monitoring is required to ensure that the airways remain open and that the patient recovers normally. Timothy was now recovering from his epileptic seizure. He was drowsy but awake and only needed a period of monitoring before his doctors could safely discharge him home. It was not long after that the attending nurse noticed Timothy's pallor. His skin had turned a shade of pale blue. She shook his hand gently and called out his name, but already it was clear that Timothy was now unresponsive. The nurse quickly checked his vital signs, but could not find his pulse. The crash team were called, but despite their very best efforts, Timothy could not be revived. He died on the 5th of March, 1991, the very same day that he'd been admitted to Ward 4. A post-mortem report later failed to provide an obvious cause of death, but his epilepsy was blamed, and despite the exceptional speed of his deterioration, the cause of his death was not looked into any further. 2 weeks after Timothy died, two very similar cases were to come to Ward 4 at Grantham Hospital. Paul Crampton, aged 5 months, and Bradley Gibson, aged 5 years, were both admitted within 24 hours of each other. Both were admitted with readily treatable chest infections, just as Kaylee Desmond had done before them, and yet both were to suffer from wholly unexpected cardiac arrests. Dr. Nana Yakara was the on-call doctor for Ward 4 that weekend. He said of Paul Crampton, "He was reasonably stable, and I even told the parents, if you want, you can take him home. But they said, 'Doctor, can we wait another day?' And I said, 'Fair enough.' Then in the early hours of the morning, I got a call. Paul had collapsed." Dr. Nana Yakara soon discovered that Paul was unexpectedly suffering from low blood sugar levels, which he was fortunately able to treat quickly. But Paul would go on to suffer 2 further collapses, requiring a total of 3 separate resuscitations. The following day, Dr. Nana Yakara found himself attending to another resuscitation, but this time it was for Bradley Gibson. In Bradley's case, the resuscitation had been unusually challenging, but his doctors were focused and unwavering in their efforts. After his sudden collapse, it took no less than 7 electric shocks to restart his heart, and the continuous compressions to Bradley's chest lasted for 32 minutes. Thanks to Dr. Nanayakara and the crash team's determination, both Bradley and Paul were restored back to life. Within one day of each other, both Bradley and Paul were transferred to the Queen's Medical Center in Nottingham, where Kaylee had gone before them. The two boys were fortunate to recover from their illnesses, and both were to return back to their families. It was now the 21st of March, 1991, and by this time, Ward 4 had experienced 5 serious and unexpected events, 2 resulting in deaths, all in the space of just 27 days. Unanticipated adverse events such as these can be quite traumatic for any ward team. Expected deaths are an inevitable sadness, but they are generally met with professional acceptance by the healthcare team. It is difficult to plan for unexpected deaths, and they tend to incite feelings of anxiety or self-doubt. Staff may begin to question themselves and even each other, wondering whether there were missed opportunities to act and make a difference to a patient's life. Or worse, there is the fear that their inadvertent actions may have actively contributed to their patient's suffering or even death. None of this is made easier when their patient is a child. There followed similar cases involving 2 further children, Michael Davidson and Yik Hung Chan. Once again, the crash team succeeded in responding to their unexplained collapses, and both were fortunate to fully recover. Ward 4 was contending with unprecedented levels of unexplained collapses, but still suspicions were yet to be aroused. Perhaps it was the continual rotation of the medical staff that prevented one individual from sensing that something was wrong, or perhaps it was simply the fact that illness and death are so commonplace in hospital that this spike in collapses was considered only a blip. Regardless of why, the care provided on Ward 4 continued undisturbed. Elsewhere in the hospital, twins Katie and Becky Phillips had just been born in the maternity department. They were kept under routine observation due to their prematurity, but on the 1st of April 1991, a bout of gastroenteritis brought Becky to Grantham's paediatric unit on Ward 4. 2 days after her admission to the ward, a nurse raised the alarm when Becky was found to be poorly responsive, cold to the touch, and with low levels of blood glucose. The doctors corrected this, and her condition quickly stabilized. Meanwhile, Katie, her twin, had been making steady progress, and once Becky had recovered, the two twins were discharged to their grateful and happy family. No one could have predicted that Becky's mild illness was about to take a catastrophic turn. During her very first night home, her mother grew concerned when Becky grew unsettled and started to make pained little grunts. The mother's confusion turned to horror when Becky began convulsing while crying out in pain. A doctor was summoned, but by the time he had arrived, Becky had settled and she lay peacefully in her bed. The doctor examined Becky carefully before reassuring the parents that nothing serious was amiss and the pain she experienced was likely due to colic. The doctor left and the child began to settle in her bed. When her mother next returned, she was faced with the worst of any parent's nightmares. 2-month-old Becky Phillips had not survived the night. Later on, a post-mortem was conducted to investigate the cause of her death. When no obvious cause was found, Becky was deemed to have died of sudden infant death syndrome, otherwise known as cot death. The matter was dismissed as just another regrettable tragedy. But the Phillips family's suffering was not yet complete. After Becky's death, her surviving twin Katie was readmitted back to Grantham Hospital as a precautionary measure. Shortly after her readmission, an increasingly familiar pattern was to follow. For no apparent reason, Katie stopped breathing, and once again the crash team was summoned to help. The resuscitation was successful and Katie recovered, but 2 days later she deteriorated again. Her second resuscitation in just 2 days had revived her failing heart, but the compressions to her chest had inadvertently fractured several of her ribs. Like the others before her, she too was transferred to Nottingham for more specialist care. Katie recovered, but already a lasting damage had been done. The failures of her heart had resulted in prolonged periods of oxygen deprivation. The damage to her brain was severe and permanent. It would leave her blind and partially paralyzed for the rest of her life. Later that month, on 22nd of April 1991, 15-month-old Claire Peck would become the latest admission to Ward 4 at Grantham Hospital. Claire had suffered from a severe asthma attack, and her collapsing airways required intubation and ventilation. This is the treatment reserved for patients who are no longer able to sustain their own breathing. Intubation is the process by which a tube is inserted into the patient's mouth. The tube is angled away from the esophagus and into the windpipe at the front of the patient's throat. The patient may then be connected to a ventilator, which pumps air through the tube, allowing their breathing to be safely controlled by their doctors. Despite receiving all of the appropriate treatments for asthma, Claire's heart began to unexpectedly fail. The crash team attended and she was swiftly resuscitated. Dr. Nelson Porter was responsible for Claire's care at the time, and although the reason for her deterioration was not entirely clear to him, he was satisfied by her response and reassured by the level of control that they now had. Having made his observations, he communicated his plan to the attending nursing staff. Then he left baby Claire to go and speak with her parents and update them with the ongoing condition of their child. Dr. Porter had been absent from Claire for not more than 2 minutes. He was mid-conversation with her parents when visibly frightened ward staff pulled him back to Claire's bedside. Against every expectation, Claire's heart had stopped once again. This time, the resuscitation was not to succeed. A cloud of suspicion now gathered ominously above Grantham Hospital. In the space of 2 months, 10 separate cases of unexplained collapses had occurred, 4 of which had resulted in the deaths of Liam Taylor, just 7 weeks old, Timothy Hardwick, 11 years old, Becky Phillips, 2 months old, and most recently Claire Peck, 15 months old. The paediatric care on Ward 4 was overseen by 2 consultants, Dr. Nanayakara and Dr. Porter, both paediatric consultants. Dr. Porter had raised concerns about the unprecedented number of collapses on Ward 4, but at that point, the 2 doctors concluded that they had just been suffering from the outdated ward facilities and in an exceptional run of bad luck. Dr. Nanayakara later said, as he recollected those events, "From my point of view, I didn't have any suspicions. Yes, I knew I was very worried, but I didn't have any suspicions at that time." Shortly after Claire Peck's death, a group of junior doctors based in Queen's Paediatric Medical Centre in Nottingham met to discuss their increasing concern at the large number of referrals that they had received from Grantham Hospital in the space of just 2 months. They had previously received 2 or 3 children every year from Grantham Hospital, but in less than 8 weeks, they had already received more than twice that number. The group of junior doctors escalated their concerns to the Professor of Paediatrics, Sir David Hull. He reviewed the facts and discussed them with his colleagues before concluding that something very serious was happening at Grantham Hospital. Sir David Hull, contacted the managers at Grantham Hospital and suggested to them that if they did not call the police, then he most certainly would. At this time, 15-month-old Claire Peck had been the most recent unexpected death on Ward 4. Her post-mortem suggested that she had died from natural causes related to her admission. By now, all of the Ward 4 post-mortem reports evidently had faith in natural causes. But neither their conclusions, nor Dr. Nana Yakara's lack of suspicion, were enough to stop the rising demand for investigation. On the 30th of April 1991, the recent events at Grantham Hospital were brought to the attention of the police. An independent medical team re-reviewed each of the children's cases. The conclusion of their report suggested that most of the episodes of collapse could be explained medically. Detective Superintendent Stuart Clifton had been assigned to the case, and he was concerned by the ambiguity of the independent medical report. Detective Clifton later said of the report, "I looked at the report and had the feeling that it was basically shutting down the inquiry." Despite Detective Clifton's concern, he faced resistance from colleagues who suggested that there was far from enough evidence to identify a criminal, let alone build a case for conviction. One very senior officer said to him at the time that he was chasing rainbows and that it was not a case worth his time and could even harm his career prospects. Even senior doctors on Ward 4 were dubious at the prospect of criminal activity. Dr. Porter felt that there may have been some concerning features surrounding Paul Crampton's collapse, but Dr. Nana Yakara's view was that there was nothing specific that pointed to illness from an unnatural cause, an opinion that was shared by many other experts. Despite the wealth of expert opinion that weighed heavily against the likelihood of criminal activity, in Detective Clifton's mind, he felt certain that someone or something was responsible for what was happening on Ward 4. But most importantly of all, Detective Clifton knew that if the experts were wrong, then there could be no doubt that more children would die. Thank you for listening to part one of this episode of Nightmares of a Doctor. Please listen to part two to continue the story. Information regarding the sources used for this episode are available in the show notes. If you have any further thoughts or feedback for the show, please feel free to get in touch via our Instagram account, Nightmares of a Doctor, or via email, nightmaresofadoctor@gmail.com.